Aloha. Welcome to The Conversation. Hawaii Talks. This is Catherine Cruz. With energy costs on the rise, could solar microgrids be the solution? Local health centers look to become more resilient and get creative. We talk about a new focus on water issues in Hawaii Nei, what's new on the gray waterfront as we look at building systems to reuse water and avoid wasting a precious resource. We hear about an upcoming Buddhist conference, Finding Peace, Finding Perfection. And on this week's Mana Minute, we meet our native duck and learn of its legend on the battlefield. Plus, a comedian gone viral on platforms like TikTok and Instagram takes the stage at Blue Note this weekend. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. To contend with rising energy costs, a number of Hawaii's community health centers want to turn to solar, and they're looking for the state to support this effort. HPR Savannah Harriman-Pote has more, and she joins us this morning. Hi, Savannah.
Good morning, Catherine.
Yeah, so you talked directly with some of the centers. What are they telling you?
So when it comes to electricity, it's by no means the largest cost that these health centers are facing, but it is very significant. And one of the people I talked to is Cheryl Vasconcelles. She's the executive director at Hana Health, which is a community provider that serves about 800 people in rural Maui. And she told me that she cries every time she opens a power bill.
Because we have them for the medical center, for our administrative offices, and for on-site housing. And electricity is becoming a big line item in our budget at this point because we've expanded services in some of our facilities and the cost of power is going up. And with the current state of world affairs right now, we're anticipating a huge increase going forward and have received notification from at least one company about how the cost of fuel will be increasing. As a result, I just got that 2 days ago. So we are anticipating a significant increase in electric as a result of the war that's taking place now.
So Hana Health is one of those centers that's looking at solar?
Yes. So it's one of five community health centers that is looking to get microgrids with battery storage across eight service locations. And these providers are all part of a partnership that's being spearheaded by the Hawaii Primary Care Association and then a small microgrid developer called Collective Energy. And Senate Bill 3254 would give $2.5 million in state funds to the Hawaii Primary Care Association to deploy the grids at these locations. And that's about a third of the total cost of the project. The rest of the funds would come from philanthropic donations as well as federal incentives for solar projects. So the centers themselves will not have to cover any of the costs of these microgrids.
So how much do they expect to save?
So the health centers are expecting to save anywhere from $30,000 to $100,000 a year on their bills, depending on the size and location. And they told me that that's money they would much rather be spending on care than on electricity. And those savings may also be critically needed as these providers contend with upcoming Medicaid cuts. All of the providers named in the bill are federally qualified health centers, meaning that they are legally required to provide services to any patient regardless of their ability to pay. So Emily Chung is the CEO of the nonprofit Hawaii Primary Care Association. She says Hawaii's federally qualified health centers, there's 14 of them across the state, are likely going to bear the brunt of looming Medicaid cuts if large portions of their patients lose coverage. And that these changes to Medicaid funding and eligibility are part of President Trump's budget bill that was signed last summer.
With the passage of H.R. 1 last year, we have a big change to our Medicaid program. And we anticipate in a worst case scenario that in Hawaii, we may see a doubling of uninsured individuals. What happens in that scenario is that our community health centers, also known as federally qualified health centers, FQHCs, they are legally required to provide services to any patient regardless of their ability to pay. So that uncompensated care cost usually doesn't get fully recouped by our community health centers, meaning they dip into their operational funds to be able to pay for those uncompensated care costs. That means that if we were to see a huge rise in uninsured populations, then we may be at a point where some of our health centers will not be able to operate fully after a few months because they don't have the large reserves.
And that's a scary place to be.
Certainly. One of those federally qualified health centers that's in line for solar is the Molokai Community Health Center. I spoke to their CEO, Milton Cortez. They serve about 2,800 people on the island of Molokai, and they're bracing for more than 400 of their patients to potentially become uninsured, which for them would mean a loss of $1.6 million starting in 2027 and then over the following 4 years. And if they were able to get a microgrid, Cortez estimates that his center would be able to save about $70,000 a year on their electric bills, which, you know, does not cancel out the loss that they'll see from having fewer Medicaid reimbursements. But he still thinks that those savings are critical as these centers are looking for truly every way to tighten their belts without compromising care. And another thing that is appealing about this project to both Vasconcelos and Cortez is that participating in the solar and battery project will give them the opportunity to have a new form of backup power. So Molokai Community Health Center currently relies on a gas power generator that Cortez joked is older than he is. And Hana Health is hooked up to a community generator, but that often requires a manual kickstart. So there are delays to power delivery for the whole center.
We still experience outages. And when it happens, it's a huge problem for us in terms of spoiled vaccinations and medications that we then have to discard. And that's thousands of dollars worth of supplies that we then need to replace. We are the only healthcare facility, so we're available 24/7 for urgent care services. So we need to have power in the clinic should an emergency come in and require immediate care before we stabilize and transport the patient out. So we have a small generator that we then have to pull it out of the closet and set it up to at least operate the urgent care room that we use, so that the doc has access to most of the equipment that's needed and there's lights on so you can actually service the patient. So for us, losing power can be a big deal in terms of putting the community's health at risk and actually people's lives at risk if we, for some reason, are unable to provide care because of a power outage.
Yeah, it's a tough thing in those rural areas.
And
what's the sense? I mean, with this bill that they're talking about, what are the chances that it's going to pass?
So right now it does have momentum. It passed an important milestone actually just yesterday. Lawmakers voted in favor of it on the Senate floor. That was its last hearing in the Senate where the bill originated. So now it's cleared to cross over to the House. It's had support so far. But there's this very small window in which this bill can be passed and lawmakers can step forward to fund this project in order for the financing of it to work as intended. Because as I stated earlier, one portion of the money for these projects is coming from the state. That's a big chunk of the pie. It's a little over a third. The rest is philanthropic donations. And then they want to leverage federal solar investment tax credit, which is only available for another couple of months. This was a solar investment tax credit that can cover up to 30% of the cost of new solar installations for businesses. But as a result of that budget bill, again, there was a new sunset date that was put on this credit. So construction on the project has to begin by July 4th of this year in order for these projects to fully qualify for that tax credit.
So they really... They have a very narrow window.
Yes, and it's an extremely short runway for lawmakers to pass this bill, for it to be enacted, and for funding to come through for them to be able to move forward these projects.
And then just to be clear, so then the microgrid systems are a bit more complex than the plug-in solar systems that we talked about earlier.
Yeah, so these are not quite utility scale, but they are considered commercial projects, and they're robust enough to not just serve these health centers now, but help them as they grow. And something that came up again and again with the health centers is they want to be a reliable place for their community members in a disaster, no matter what kind of conditions might be going on. So they want to make sure that they can keep the lights on and people can come to them. They can be a safe harbor.
Yeah, it's an important service to provide to our community. But thank you so much, Savannah.
Thank you, Catherine.
That was HPR Savannah Harriman-Pote, who covers climate and energy issues for us. Look for her stories on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Ulupono Initiative and Ruby Tuesday Hawaii.
HPR and Shangri-La present a special Live from the Atherton performance with Basil and the Supernaturals, a Syrian-American neo-soul and funk ensemble. Join Basil and the Supernaturals on Thursday, March 26th at 6 p.m. Tickets at hprtickets.org. Live from the Atherton is sponsored by HMSA.
Support for HPR comes from Nereid Hawaii, which supports nonprofits committed to helping families of agricultural workers and retirees with affordable housing, such as the Kunia Village Development Corporation, nereidhawaii.com.
Hawaii Business Magazine is kicking off a year-long series on Hawaii's water woes. It is partnering with the Kupa'a Network, which has been the driving force for the media outlet you may know as Overstory Hawaii, which we featured before on The Conversation. Overstory is now rebranding as the Hawaii Community Journal. We spoke with Hawaii Business Magazine editor Jennifer Ablan and Kupa'a editor Mea Aloha Spady this morning. Spady starts us off. 2025 was one of the driest years ever in the more than 100 years since we've been tracking rainfall. That's why water is a major focus of this series.
Exploring solutions has always been core to our work at the Kupa'a Network, and Overstory is our journalism program. Started very early on speaking with residents about what's important to them. And Hawaii Community Journal can really be seen as an evolution of Overstory. We are still core to the mission of listening to residents and bringing the mission forward to help them better understand the systems that shape daily life in Hawaii. And we're going to continue to cover things like housing or water or environment and health. And what will continue to be the pillar of what we do is focusing on responses to problems through solutions journalism. And so your question to why water, I think that we have seen some great coverage from your organization and others on water. And additionally, when we went out to speak with residents about what's important to them, we heard requests for stories on water, water resources, and also stories that incorporate nuance as far as cultural and historical context, the multiple players that are involved. And so we want to be able to bridge those multiple perspectives alongside Hawaii Business Magazine to bring readers and our shared audiences in Hawaii a deeper and fuller understanding of this complex topic.
Yes, and Jennifer, maybe this is the time for you to jump in here. You've kicked this off looking at ways to reuse water. And what caught my eye is that here on Oahu, we've got the first high-rise that's going up that incorporates a plan for gray water.
Absolutely. So Hawaii is facing a slow-moving water crisis, and rainfall patterns are becoming more unpredictable, temperatures are rising, and demand for water continues to grow. So, you know, most of the state's drinking water comes from aquifers, which are underground natural storage places for water. These underground reservoirs recharge slowly, so when we pump more water out than rainfall replaces, the system becomes strained. That's why experts are increasingly looking at solutions like gray water reuse to reduce pressure on those underground reserves. Now, I got fascinated because there is a business angle to this. Water scarcity affects far more than drinking water. It touches agriculture, tourism, development, and even public safety. And farmers are already struggling with drought conditions, and water shortages can disrupt major events and economic activity. For example, the PGA Tour has historically brought roughly $50 million annually to Maui's economy, showing how closely water reliability is tied to tourism and large events. So when water becomes limited, the ripple effects move through the entire economy. Gray water is lightly used water from showers, bathroom sinks, and laundry. And instead of sending it straight into the sewer system, it can be captured, treated, and reused for things like irrigation or flushing toilets. That reduces how much drinking quality water buildings need every day. And, you know, I started poking around in terms of who's using gray water. And of course, Hawaii is beginning to experiment with this approach, really taking San Francisco's blueprint at Kualea Place in Honolulu. It's a large residential development that will include one of the state's first on-site gray water reuse systems.
I happen to drive by that construction site every day, every morning. And so that really caught my attention, that this will be a model for potentially, you know, other high rises.
Exactly. So the system is expected to recycle about 30,000 gallons of water per day and save roughly 11 million gallons of drinking water each year. And the state is beginning to work with clean tech partners in San Francisco to explore innovative water reuse and efficiency technologies that could expand these kinds of systems across the island.
Well, you know, this is just such an important issue to the entire state. And, you know, Maya, we just had the Maui mayor on, and, you know, the drama that's playing out with East Maui and West Maui water issues, you know, with the PGA canceling the tournament there. I mean, so much is tied into water use.
Sure. And I think that, you know, depending on what use case we are talking about, there are multiple perspectives in each space. And so one of the articles we did last year was actually about the East Maui residents and their request to put the water back into public hands. And so, you know, we heard from Namoku Apuni Oko'olauhui, who has cared for a lo'i there, for 400 acres of lo'i, for years, generations. And they have been talking about fresh water for quite some time. And so this is where you can kind of see the overlap of how we will be bringing the environmental and social impacts into this conversation and some cultural context, whereas Jennifer is really going to encapsulate the economic implications of what our communities are doing, because we really want to look at responses. We really, and what we are hearing over and over again from residents when we do go to these community hearings, we do go out to place and talk to people, is there are ideas for solutions. So we really want to dig deeper into specifically that. What are these responses? What are these solutions that various communities are trying to undertake? And what are the limitations or possibilities of those?
Okay, well, it's an intriguing subject, and we look forward to the coverage for the rest of the year. But thank you both so much for spending time with us this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you, Catherine.
We've been hearing from Hawaii Business Magazine editor Jennifer Ablon and Mea Aloha Spady of the Kupa'a Network. HawaiiCommunityJournal.org is the link to the rebranded Overstory site. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz.
Ulanai, o Maui, o Kahoolawe, o Hawaii.
We are venturing into a native forest for today's quiz, and we've got our eye on a distinctive native plant. Because of its unique appearance, we think describing its flowers will give the answer away. But what we can tell you is that this tree belongs to a group called coral trees. There are more than 100 species of them worldwide, but only one is native to Hawaii. But an invasive wasp has been damaging this tree, leading scientists to turn to biocontrol measures. Hawaiians use the lightweight wood of this tree to build canoes and surfboards, while its flowers were strong into vibrant lei. And according to one Hawaiian proverb, or Olelo Noiau, this plant shares a seasonal connection to shark bites. For today's quiz, can you name our mystery tree? Call 808-941-3689 or toll-free 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag from HPR. You'll also score a deck of the card game Kumulaau, courtesy of Trees for Honolulu's Future.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nāreit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits providing affordable housing for families of agricultural workers and retirees, such as the Kunia Village Development Corporation. NāreitHawaii.com.
This week, the Imin Center at the University of Hawaii Manoa campus plays host to a Buddhist conference. Michelle Moore is a professor of the school's Department of Religion and Ancient Civilizations. Raised in Switzerland by agnostic parents, he says, set him on a path that led him to Japan and then Hawaii. The conference is an academic look at Buddhist nature and its universal appeal.
So the theme is intrinsic perfection. And it focuses on the idea of Buddha nature that became prevalent across all the Chinese-speaking areas in Asia from the 5th century, roughly, of the Common Era, and then spread out like wildfire to neighboring places, including Japan, Korea, Vietnam, and all of Central Asia.
So you're going back to the origins of the religion and its spread.
It's not the origin of Buddhism, but the origin of this particular concept of Buddha nature that goes back to the 5th century. But we're also focusing on its universal appeal because the question of ultimate identity is not something that is unique to the Buddhist traditions. It's something that is widespread across all religious paths toward understanding what is our true identity.
And we often think of Buddha who looks inward for peace. And as we are living through some very tumultuous times, what is it that you want to share with our listeners?
It's that regime change. Regimes, there are lots of regimes. If we look at history, things arise and pass. And so is the flux of our existence. Therefore, this awareness of impermanence might be somehow soothing. And on the other hand, we cannot change others. Therefore, beginning by trying to change oneself or to discover one's true identity is one of the avenues that is proposed in those traditions that emphasize meditation and self-discovery.
And in putting this conference together, you expect to draw, what, a number of people from across the globe?
It's open to the local community, but among the scholars that we invited, we have the best experts in the world coming from Europe, Asia, and all kinds of backgrounds, but they're all somehow specialized in this particular area. There will be one exception, which is the keynote address that will also deal with the question of nanophysics and AI, which are relevant to the contemporary discourse. So we try to bridge the gap between purely religious studies and contemporary concerns.
And then why do you think these concepts, why they grew during this particular time frame? What was the appeal?
Yeah, so it's a revolutionary idea that everyone is endowed with a Buddha nature or with a perfect nature. And therefore, it undermines all pretenses for the superiority of a particular ethnic group or a particular group of people. It's pretty corrosive in its ultimate implications.
I'm just thinking back to my high school classes of comparative religions back in the day and really trying to understand one's place in the world and the beliefs that you embrace. What else can you share with why you felt it was important to be talking about this right now?
Because it's a segment of intellectual and religious history that has been to a large extent neglected. There has been more focus on Indian and Tibetan religions and their formulation of those concepts, but the way it was transferred through Central Asia to East Asia is something that needs to receive additional attention. And it has become mainstream Buddhism in most of the countries that embrace the great vehicle, Mahayana.
And I'm just trying to think, what are the conditions or the factors that made it spread during that time?
It was certain groups of people who were practicing meditation mostly. It came from their own experiential realization of this particular dimension of their identity. They became aware of their own Buddha nature and therefore wanted to spread the message that it's not something that needs to be acquired or that can be cultivated, but is there from the beginning.
When I think of Buddha, I think of just peace, quieting the spirit that is somehow vexed by what's going on in the world.
Yeah, so we can say that it's very easy to realize that we're not ultimately our own physical body, because the body disappears eventually. And we can come to the realization that the mind similarly does not endure forever. So especially the chatter of the mind is something that can be silenced.
And then what got you interested in Buddhism?
I was really fascinated by the fact that at least the early forms of Buddhism were emphasizing rationality and therefore seemed more relevant to the current discourses. It's not predicated necessarily on belief first, but things need to be verified. There's a huge amount of encouragement to practitioners to see for themselves instead of taking the words of the Buddha for granted.
And then talk about the harmony with the physical world and the spiritual mind, bringing that together.
Yes, so we can emphasize, of course, differences. That's very easy. But if we start thinking about what bridges those differences, first of all, it precludes all the divisions between ethnicities and nationalities, countries, and all those false identifications. But also it bridges the gap with other forms of existence, other forms of life. Buddhist texts often describe the six realms that include animals and other forms of existence. And everything is part of the same wheel of becoming. There is no exceptions. So it's more conducive maybe to a certain ecological worldview.
It's a balance,
yes.
A real balance. Anything else that you think our listeners should know when they try and appreciate what Buddhism has to offer?
I think it's not exclusively Buddhism. I think that all religious traditions that emphasize the need to discover one's own true identity are relevant to this discourse. Some people may call it divine nature. In this case, it is called Buddha nature, but it talks about the same thing. It talks about this ultimate identity, and also we could call it the fundamental ground that we all share.
And do you recall when you were first introduced to this concept, when you said, wait a minute, there's something here?
Yes, I came repeatedly across this idea. I used to study mostly Zen Buddhism, and there are lots of dialogues that include the incentive to discover one's own true nature. And there's a famous koan. Koan is like a little bit like a riddle. And one teacher famously asked his disciple, does even a dog have the Buddha nature? And at one point, the teacher replies, no. Whereas all scriptures emphasize the fact that all forms of existence do have the Buddha nature. So this puzzle becomes the incentive for delving deep into meditation and has been used throughout many centuries of history.
And then, excuse my ignorance, what are the differences of Buddhism?
Yes, there are so many different denominations. And on the Hawaiian islands, we have a lot of Pure Land presence, especially true Pure Land. The Jodo Shinshu in its various iterations is more prevalent, and it has an orientation that is more devotional in essence. It talks a lot about the other power, the power of the Buddha Amitabha or Amida, and surrendering to this other power. Whereas traditions that emphasize meditation such as Zen tend to encourage practitioners to delve deeper into themselves to find this source of peace and to discover what they truly are.
And then how large do you think the Buddhist community is here in the islands? Do we have a sense?
Yes, we don't have exact numbers because it overlaps between the Japanese, Chinese, Korean, Vietnamese. Even we have Theravada traditions from Southeast Asia, Tibetan traditions, etc. So adherence, I don't know even if there is an official statistics about the number of followers, but it's certainly a significant segment of the population.
We've been hearing from Professor Michelle Moore of the University of Hawaii's Department of Religions and Ancient Civilization. The conference runs March 12th to 13th this week. Look for links on our website later today.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Olson Trust, envisioning a Hawaii where its people are supported by the land, and the land is taken care of by its people. OlsonTrust.com.
Oil prices have been really volatile since the war started. Gasoline has gotten more expensive in the U.S. than it was before the war started. And you're seeing governments in many parts of the world start to make policy changes. Ration energy.
I'm Natalie Kitroev. That's Today on the Daily from the New York Times.
Beginning this evening at 6:30.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, whose contributors help Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Honolulu Waldorf School.
This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. We now go to this week's Manu Minute. University of Hawaii at Hilo Professor Patrick Hart introduces us to the Kaloa Maoli, or Hawaiian duck.
Kaloa Maoli, or the Hawaiian duck, is found only in Hawaii and is the only native duck species still present in the main Hawaiian islands. They're very close relatives of the mallard ducks that are commonly fed by children in public ponds and lakes. Unlike mallards, though, male and female Kaloa Maoli are harder to tell apart. Both sexes have orange legs and feet and an overall mottled brown body. They also have greenish-blue patch of wing feathers known as a speculum that is easily seen when they're swimming. Adult males are usually darker overall and have a brown bill, while females have a dull orange bill. So, if you see a pair of ducks that are similar looking and look like female mallards, there's a good chance you're looking at native Hawaiian ducks. Kaloa Maoli quack in a similar way to mallards, and this quack may have played an important role in Hawaiian history. It's said that Imai Kalani, the fierce Ali'i warrior of Kau on Hawaii Island, was blind, but was aided in his battles by two Kaloa Maoli that would hover above and report to him through their quacks the direction of anyone approaching him in battle. He could then throw spears with deadly accuracy at his opponents. Koloa Maoli eat a variety of aquatic plants, green algae, and aquatic invertebrates like mollusks, snails, and crustaceans. They were still abundant and regularly hunted across Hawaii until much of their habitat was drained and converted to sugar plantations by the end of the 1800s. This is also around the time that mongoose were introduced, which found these ground-nesting ducks to be easy prey. By the early 1900s, Koloa Maoli were very difficult to find, and by 1962 there were fewer than 500 individuals left, restricted to the islands of Kauai and Niihau, which, non-coincidentally, were the only islands without mongoose. They were federally listed as an endangered species in 1967, soon after a captive breeding program began. Captive-bred birds were released on the Big Island, Maui, and Oahu. A few hundred still exist in upland ponds and streams on Hawaii Island, but the ones on Maui and Oahu have all interbred with introduced mallards, so mainly exist as Hawaiian duck hybrids. The best place nowadays to see non-hybrid Koloa Maoli is the island of Kauai, where as many as 2,000 birds inhabit wetlands, ponds, and taro fields. For Hawaii Public Radio, this is Patrick Hart from the UH Hilo Department of Biology.
Support for Manu Minute comes from Ken and Patty Kupchak for the Friends of Oahu National Wildlife Refuges, supporting their communities, habitats, and wildlife. More about helping at friendsofoahunwr.org.
And now it's time to unveil our backyard quiz answer and our mystery tree. Earlier, we told you about a native plant that's a member of the group called coral trees. These trees are known for their twisting branches and red or orange flowers and are found in tropical areas worldwide. A coral tree is the official city tree of Los Angeles, California, and parts of Venezuela and Okinawa also use different species of coral trees as their floral emblems. But one species of coral tree is found in Hawaii and nowhere else in the world. The name for this tree means repeatedly twisted in Hawaiian language and refers to the seed pods of this plant, which twist open to reveal its seeds. In recent years, the tree has been threatened by the introduction of a non-native wasp, leading conservation officials to turn to biocontrol measures. We asked for the name of this native tree species. We were looking for Wili Wili, and the wise saying, or Olelo Noiau, that we referenced earlier, well, it said that when the Wili Wili blooms, the sharks bite. And congrats to Michelle, who's a plant enthusiast. She knew the answer. That's our quiz for today. If you have one to share, write to TalkBack at hawaiipublicradio.org.
When you want more than just the headlines, that's when you turn to the conversation to get the broader and deeper perspective on the stories you're following.
You know, when you have an earthquake that's that big, it was an 8.7 magnitude earthquake, that could have been a huge wave, could have been a 20 or 30 foot wave. And a few people went out toward the ocean. I got to tell you, if this thing had just tipped a little bit differently on the seafloor, they could have been killed by a wave.
The fire was real close to Kaanapali. We could see the smoke billowing from exactly where we are, and that brought about a lot of post-traumatic experiences.
Sea level rise is essentially a permanent condition. It's going to cause flooding of many different types, and it's going to be unrelenting, accelerating, and inevitable.
Empower journalism that takes you deeper. Donate at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Homegrown comedian Charlene Kay is set to appear at the Blue Note this weekend. Kay has been making her mark on platforms like Instagram and TikTok through musical parodies. Impressions of artists like Taylor Swift and K-pop boy bands are her thing. She caught the eye of the New York Times, which recently featured her Radiohead cover band. Kay spoke with The Conversation's Maddie Bender about her Honolulu upbringing. She credits one local comedian in particular for shaping her style.
One of the first comedians I ever saw was Frank DeLima. I don't think I really realized what an impact his humor had on me until I started writing musical parody. Like, he was my Weird Al. He had this like Filipino Christmas song. And I don't know why I still know this, but when you're a kid, you just kind of like internalize it, but it was to the tune of, you'll hear those sleigh bells ringing and ring, ding, ding, ling, too. And his was, baka dang, dang, so, yup, billy goat, dang, gala, gala, goat, boy. Gala, gala, billy goat, dala, billy boy, so, sala, silly toy, too. Baka dang, dang, sala, yup, billy goat, dang, gala, gala, boat, boat, gala, gala, billy goat, dala, billy boy, so, sala, silly toy, too. And it was all about balut, like balut, 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 like making fun of how Filipinos like balut, which is like the fertilized egg. and I remember when I was in Camilla Wiki, he came in one day and he like gave us a talk. It was like an inspirational talk about like growing up and stuff. And I heard that he still performs. He's like in his 80s. And like, I just like, he made such an impact on my sense of humor. And when I think back on that, I'm like, wow, that really was formative.
Your show, Tiger Daughter, or How I Brought My Immigrant Mother, Ultimate Shame, that's the show you've been touring around bringing to the Blue Note. Do you think it would surprise people to know that Tiger Mothers exist even in Honolulu, even in Hawaii?
Probably especially in Honolulu and Hawaii, because it has such a big Asian population. And it's so interesting because I grew up in the islands, and my mom, like a lot of the experiences that I talk about in the show happened in Hawaii and with my Haole Jewish dad who adopted me. So I think it's going to be extremely meaningful. And it's also interesting that the people that are coming to the show are a lot of my classmates from like sixth grade and their moms themselves, and they're Asian as well. And they're like trying to figure out how they can be a better mom and how that relates to like a tiger mom parenting style, because the education system is so cutthroat, especially if you want to go to Punahou like they did. So it's been a really beautiful journey to understand that I wrote it for myself and like to understand my relationship with my mom. And I really thought that the first time I did it, it was going to just be a little bit too niche if you weren't Asian, if you didn't have an intense childhood. And turns out that's most people. And so I'm really delighted that like the more personal art is, the more universal, the more universal it ultimately becomes. And I love that like over the years I've met people like me who are like Asian millennials. And then I also meet Greek grandmothers who are like, you told my story. Or I'll meet people who are like from Australia and they're like, I wanted to be a clown and my mom wanted me to be a dentist. And it's the same story. It's just like you have very specific experiences of like, you know, for example, my mom always wanted to be a singer, but she never got the opportunity to because she grew up in poverty in Singapore. And then she sacrificed everything to bring her kids to America. And like, what happens when your firstborn daughter ends up having the opportunities that you had and becoming the thing that you wanted to be? It's very complicated. And there's a lot of really like tender feelings and also a lot of competition that happens between mothers and daughters, especially eldest daughters, that I didn't realize was so common until I started doing this every night all over the world. And like, I would just talk to people after the show and they were like, oh, I have this relationship with my mother and or my father. And like, it's been very healing.
And there, I mean, there's especially now a long line of comedians, women comedians, talking about their relationships with their mothers. I think of Jeanette McCurdy's I'm Glad My Mom Died, everything Rachel Bloom has ever done. But I don't know. Do you think there's more of a willingness to poke fun at our relationships with our mothers? Or do all comedians just have mommy issues?
I would wager to say that everyone has some kind of parental issue. Like, no one gets out of this alive. No parent is perfect. I think that there's so much comedy in the misunderstanding of it all. And I feel like, yeah, over the years, I've just been like, why am I like this? Why is my mother like this? And then, like, of course, like, the deeper you go into her history, the more you understand that it comes from a very specific place for her. And without giving away the show too much, it's frustrating and also inevitable that you wish that you could understand each other. But the main question of the show is, do you have to understand someone to love them? And that is something that I think about all the time in this political climate, like when everything is so divisive and we're really struggling for common ground. And like, how do we understand each other and how do we have compassion for each other while also like holding each other accountable to hurt and harm?
I did want to ask about your musicianship and also your comedy. A lot of it is musical comedy. Younger listeners might know your work from coming across you on Reels or on TikTok doing bits like what all Lady Gaga songs sound like.
Lady Gaga, the thing I love the most about Lady Gaga, no words, just gibberish. Just a bunch of gibberish, and then she says her own name. She's like a goth minion in that way. You gotta go.
Well, mama, unana, onomatopoeia, abracadabra, boo boo bee bee ga ga ga.
How do you think your perspective, though, as a musician and singer-songwriter, helps inform the way that you critique the industry with some of the songs, like the every insert name here song?
Yeah. So I started playing classical music when I was 5, like any good little Asian. And I played piano all up until, I mean, I still play piano. I have a very different relationship with it now, but I started to listen to the radio. So that made me love punk music. It made me fall in love with nu metal and rock. And so I really loved Blink-182 and System of a Down and like Limp Bizkit. And it was like the early 2000s. And I was just like a punk kid who wanted to play guitar. And so because I started to become more of an instrumentalist, I started to write songs. Like from then until now, I've always been so academic about music, and I've always had a really like distinct interest in deconstructing music. And my brain sticks onto patterns very easily. So I notice when certain artists do the same thing, and it's helped me break it down in a way that other people can easily understand because I have such an analytical mind. And I also have a sense of humor. And so I couldn't help but notice that Taylor Swift uses this very particular chord structure. And she also sings really fast every time she gets to the bridge, or like Ed Sheeran only sings about how much he hates his record label or how much he loves his wife. And there's no in between, you know? And so I just found it easy to mimic these styles and also just to entertain myself. And like, there was, when I started doing it, I was like, everybody thinks like this, right? Everyone like has noticed these things, right? And they have. It's just that they weren't able to articulate it in the same way that I have. And then all of a sudden they were like, oh my God, like it always does end that way. And Lady Gaga does sound like a goth minion when she just says a bunch of random gibberish and then ends with her own name.
And there are layers. I mean, ultimately there are layers to the jokes you make about them in your musical parodies. And I think that's pretty emblematic of your style. And I was wondering if you could unpack the creation of one of your bits. So the Bobby Lee bit, which is another one that I am totally obsessed with.
Oh my gosh, thank you. Thank you so much.
I think my favorite part of it is that at no point can you really guess what you're going to do next.
So experts agree, Charlene is Bobby and Bobby's Charlene. Every Asian's interchangeable. Scientifically, we're one and the same. Have you ever wondered seen us in the same room at the same time? I am Bobby, and Bobby is me. I'm also Connie Chung, Ali Wong, Bruce Lee. Bruce is Bobby's dad, because his name is also Lee, though Bobby is Korean, and Bruce is Chinese. Korea is just a different part of China. Japan is a city in China. India is also...
Talk about where that joke came from and then how all these elements got added on to it.
Oh my gosh, thank you. I feel so seen because I do always want my comedy to have that that deeper layer of commentary. And I'm fascinated with the experience of being an Asian woman and how frequently I get compared to Cassandra Wong from Wayne's World, who was an icon of mine growing up, but she's also a character invented by white men and she's not a real person. It remained the single most frequent comparison I got until Bobby Lee. And I could tell that I was becoming more successful as a comedian than a musician at a certain point, because people stopped commenting, "Oh my gosh, you are such a great guitar player," and more, "This chick looks like Bobby Lee." And it was so frequent. Like every time I opened my phone, it was like, "She looks like Bobby Lee. She's Bobby Lee in a dress. I didn't know Bobby Lee was doing drag now. Wow, Bobby shreds." And I was like, is this really what people think? Like, do they think I look like this man wearing a beanie with a goatee and like peach fuzz? It was at once completely ridiculous and like kind of racist and sexist. And then on the other hand, I kind of see it. So the song was like, what if Bobby Lee and I were the same person and you just never saw us in the same room at the same time? And the bit is that like, I'm just yes anding the internet and saying, yeah, we are the same person. I'm Bobby. Bobby is me. But if that's true, I'm also Connie Chung, Ali Wong, Bruce Lee. And then there's some of my favorite lines in that song, like, but Bobby's Korean and Bruce's Chinese. Oh, well, Korea is just a different part of China. And that's something that I've said my whole life. People are like, oh, well, you Asians look the same. Oh, you look Korean. Because I've also been told that I look Korean because I have a very square face and I have a pretty defined jawline, which I've been told is like a feature of Korean people, but I'm Chinese. And so when people used to tell me that, I'd be like, ah, Korea is just a different part of China. And so I'm so happy that I finally found a home for it musically. And like the clincher of that song when I perform it live is that I actually did meet Bobby Lee and I took a video of us together to prove that we are two different people. But I met him at this comedy party and I was like, hey, do you know who I am? And he was like, yeah, you're the girl that wrote the Bobby Lee song. And I was like, oh my God. It was a very sweet moment. And he gets it. He's in
it. It had that catharsis at the end, which is like all great jokes, right? Have some type of payoff. It also breaks into Grease at some point.
Oh, yeah. My roommate was singing, "Look at me, I'm Bobby Lee." And I thought that was hilarious. And I was like, I got to put that in the song.
Is there anything else you want to add? Anything you want listeners to know before your show?
Yeah. So my mom is going to be at this show because it's a hometown show and she will be singing a song with me. So she's going to expect a packed house. So don't let me down, Honolulu. Show Lily that she is a star. She is famous. It's just that nobody knows it yet. So prove her right.
Charlene Kay, thank you so much for taking the time today.
Thank you, Maddie.
Well, that was comedian Charlene Kay, who appears at Blue Note in Waikiki on Sunday, March 15th. And FYI, Blue Note is an HPR underwriter. Well, we have to go now, but up tomorrow, we plan to hear from Kauai Mayor Derek Kawakami. He's set to release his State of the County address later today. And with a heavy storm beginning to hit the islands, how's your neighborhood faring? Let us know. Call our talkback line 808-792-8217 or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find our archive shows on our website or look for the Conversation podcast on Spotify or Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.